Igor Stravinsky was still in his 20s when he wrote the score for the Firebird Ballet. The success not only catapulted him to international acclaim, but launched the career of a composer whose style altered the entire course of music in the 20th century. The Atlanta Ballet performs the Firebird this weekend with a live orchestra. I spoke with the orchestra's conductor, Beatrice Affron, about why this music was so extraordinary.
It was such a special time in Paris, and I think that's part of the success, to take nothing away from this gorgeous piece of music itself. It was a time in Paris when there was this huge fascination building with all things Russian. And part of his job in composing this music for a ballet to be based on a Russian fairy tale, really two fairy tales put together, was to infuse it with these magical and Russian colors, which he did. But what he did on top of that, which I think he was so proud of, I've read, and fascinated audiences, was to sort of move beyond the fabulous teachings of his mentor, Rimsky-Korsakov, and to start to experiment with amazing musical colors and effects. Stravinsky himself said that he was proudest of this moment very early in the ballet where the strings play harmonics going up and down. And a harmonic is where a string player is just barely touching the string and it sounds very eerie and magical. And I think it was sort of the opening of the door to an even broader, more exciting palette of musical colors.
Stravinsky's Firebird is best known as a concert work, usually played by a symphony orchestra as part of a concert program,
right,
in suite form. What was different for you about approaching the score as a ballet for it to be danced?
I think I'm fortunate in that I've only conducted it as a ballet. This is the second version that I've done. The other version of it that I did was the original 50-minute long ballet.
The
1910, with slightly reduced orchestration because, as Stravinsky himself acknowledged later, it was kind of a waste. He called it a waste of musical forces. It was, in other words, it was originally orchestrated for a very, very large orchestra. And he acknowledged that most ballet companies would not be able to afford or even to fit that many people in orchestra pits. And so then when he created his three suites, 1911 and then 1919 and 1945, which is the version we're doing here in Atlanta, he reduced the size of the orchestra. And then he also changed the duration.
So beyond just sitting down and playing the music, do the musicians and dancers do anything else to get into each other's heads, since you're so familiar with it as essentially accompaniment, although it's difficult to think of this music as collaboration rather than
right. I know. I've been thinking about that actually. It's a piece that's so powerful by itself that it's really hard to think of it as just an accompaniment, even though those were the instructions that Fokine gave Stravinsky. He really preached at him, saying, no, the music is in the service of the dance. And Stravinsky found that very annoying, but he also said he learned what he appreciated was getting very specific instructions about the durations of certain numbers and so on. But yes, this is one of those pieces, sort of like Carmina Burana, in the sense that the audience, you know, is going to, many of them will be coming just as much to hear the music as to see the dance. And there's so much interest coming out of the pit. Those are my favorite types of pieces to conduct for ballet, where the dancers are on their own time listening to the music and studying it and getting to know it, and the musicians are watching the videotape and getting to know that as well. So there's a real back and forth, I think, that's been going on in the days leading up to performance week.
The Firebird is based on Russian folk tales. The storylines lend themselves beautifully to the ballet narrative. Could you also take us through which of the most famous numbers correspond to the story?
Sure, of course. So the ballet opens with this very murky music that's played in very low strings. And in this version, actually what we see at the outset is the cachet, who is this evil sorcerer who has imprisoned the 13 princesses, whose soul resides in an egg. And is deathless, but if the egg breaks, that's the end of the cachet. So the scene opens and we see him and his minions. Then we transition to the prince, Ivan, in this version, who is wandering around in the forest and encounters, of course, the Firebird. So her very famous solo comes very soon into the ballet. Right after that, there's a beautiful dance for the two of them, the pas de deux between Ivan and the Firebird. And this is where you really have a sense of Stravinsky being very deliberate about creating magical musical effects. And he releases her. You know, she's so fearful that he's hunting her, because that's in fact why he is in that forest. But he releases her. She gives him a feather, and she basically says, you know, if you're ever in need of help, please use the feather. And then the princesses come along, and they're very playful. The lead princess, she doesn't have a name, is very spunky and kind of very down to earth. And something I like about this particular version is that the otherworldly and the down to earth are not only clearly delineated in the music, but also in the choreography. It's very, very clear that those are two separate realms. And of course, the prince and the princess fall in love and dance a beautiful pas de deux. This beautiful duet is broken up, of course, by the bad guy. The cachet shows up. And there is a very famous infernal dance, it's called, which is really the showdown between the prince, who pulls out the feather and calls the Firebird, who helps ultimately vanquish the cachet. After that, we get the wonderful lullaby where the Firebird returns and basically awakens the kingdom again, and the gorgeous hymn at the end celebrating a very kind of Russian religious feeling of sort of triumph and peace in the realm.
I have goosebumps. just thinking about that hymn redemption, the transcendent quality of it, and it's so powerful.
It's so powerful and so joyful too. It's not a mournful hymn, and when he does that by playing it slowly and then playing it fast and then slowing things down, and it's just, it's very Russian and very joyful and very memorable.
Why aren't there more women conductors?
That's a very good question. Way back when I was studying, generally there were as many women as men in the classroom, whether it was at summer festivals or conservatory classes. And then people went off to their various jobs, and that's where the separation started to happen. The good part of this is that there are many ways to be a conductor, and there are many places to be a conductor, in colleges and universities, in churches, in ballet companies and symphony orchestras. But we do tend to lose the women in the more visible jobs. And I read an article recently about there is an opera company in Texas that is building a program specifically to attract women conductors. So I hugely applaud that. And other efforts, it's just like everything else. You have to bring awareness and education, and there are some women who are really starting to be very prominent. And then, of course, every 5 years or so, some eminent male conductor will say something really disparaging about women conductors. Oh, women should stick to conducting Mozart or Debussy, you know, and Stravinsky is out of the question. You know, Shostakovich, forget it. And then there's an outcry, and then it sort of fades away, and then it comes back in a few years. I have no explanation for it except that it's reactionary and stupid.
But I applaud your work, Beatrice Efron.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.